As you know, we've partnered with Bitbox, makers of the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. It's a secure, open source, Bitcoin-only hardware wallet with the best user experience in the industry. I personally use it to guarantee that I'll always have access to some of my Bitcoin in cold storage whenever I travel. If you want to check out a Bitbox O2, you can use the promo code HIGHHASHRATE to get 5% off your purchase or go to bitbox.swiss/HIGHHASHRATE. All one word, no spaces. Check them out. Ah, screw it. Here we go.
Sailor, if you look at his appearances, he had one really crash and burn podcast appearance, I thought, with Marty Bent about 3 years ago when he first came on the scene. And since then, he only goes on podcasts for which he can basically deliver, or during which he can basically deliver a prepared statement with very little interaction with the host.
Hey, everybody. This is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps. Yo, welcome back to High Hash Rate. Today, we've got the other half of the Canadian Bitcoin podcast. We had Len, now we got Joey. Joey tweets. He's basically a professional podcaster. Those guys pretty much do like 10 shows a week. So
you guys look professional as hell, that's true.
You guys have a professional setup, and look, I don't know how you guys keep up with stuff to talk about. Although weeks like this, it's easy. So, but let's introduce the guest. What's up, Joey?
Not much, man. It's good to see you guys. Good to finally, quote unquote, meet ya. I gotta be honest with you. I didn't know a ton about your show before you guys started talking to Len. I've been listening though. I really like it. I think, you know, you may think we do a lot of shows, but I think these days, like you mentioned, there's plenty of stuff to talk about. And I appreciate like the similarity in banter, let's say, and tone between the two programs. I think you guys are good friends by the sounds of things. Len and I are good friends, so it's always good to podcast with people who are aligned in more ways than one. I'm happy to be here.
For sure. I think that part of this whole, like, even just starting a podcast, there's a million of them already. For me, it was just getting to do this, like getting to talk to people, get to hang out, getting to meet people. You can't go to a conference every weekend, right? So you can still talk to people every week. But yeah, man, I really like the show. I've been catching some of the episodes lately, have been great. And I do want to get into the Bitcoin Magazine interview that you did yesterday,
man,
right?
The bodies are still warm, man. Are you kidding me?
I want to talk about that. It was a really interesting conversation, but there's so much more going on right now. And it feels like the drama between Bitcoin Magazine and social media is like the 10th thing on the list that matters right now. Yeah, Roger Ver just got arrested. Samurai team just got arrested. They're coming after Cash App. They're coming after like Lightning service providers. Sailor's trying to do KYC with Ordinals. There's just a whole lot, man. I don't know where to start. Maybe you can share your thoughts on whatever of those issues that you've got the most thoughts about.
I think we should start with Mike today. I haven't done that much research into the whole ID on Bitcoin via the Ordinals protocol yet, but I just like who's asking for this stuff? Sailor, right. Sailor's a weird kind of character in my mind for like as far as Bitcoin goes for a couple of reasons. One, I don't know where this guy came from, you know, so to speak. You know, he's MicroStrategy, blah, blah, blah. Everyone knows the company's been around a long time, .com crash and rebound and whatnot. But I'm a little worried that a guy who seems to have that much riz, as the kids say, just hadn't found an angle through which or with which to amass like a great deal of wealth before Bitcoin came around. Now he's obviously doing like these equity offerings and whatnot and convertible bond offerings and stuff like that. But I worry about that. And then I see the amount of Bitcoin the guy holds. He's at a little bit above 1% of the total supply, not the total issued, but the total ever. And now he wants to do what looks to me like, you know, as you said there, Dan, like KYC centric stuff on a protocol that's really supposed to be more about freedom and in some respects, anonymity. I realize it's transparent and maybe not the best place to conduct, you know, gray activities. But I just don't know who's looking for this kind of stuff on Bitcoin. It seems to me like, you know, I hear a lot about how Bitcoiners are apathetic to a lot of the stuff that goes on in Bitcoin, whether it's ordinals or other stuff. If that's true, then those people don't really care about this. Like, no one's looking for a replacement for, like, you know, Shopify or whatever on Bitcoin. And, you know, the other half of Bitcoin is like the maximalist crowd. They're not looking for this either. So who's looking for it? This is like a lot of red meat to dangle for the sailor is a spook crowd. And right. It's like a bizarre time to do it when all this other stuff is going on. I mean, it's like a read the room situation here. Even if you had this planned before, as you mentioned, like Samurai, Ver, all these other, you know, sort of more relevant, I would argue more important events, just hold it for a day or two, or like consider the messaging, you know, amend the delivery. I don't know. I don't like any of this personally. What do you guys make of it? Like, I'd be curious.
So what little I know about it, because this is pretty fresh, and I can't say that I'm a expert on the protocol or ordinals in general, but what it sounds like is it's some sort of use of you based on previous outputs. So if you keep transacting in like this UTXO or this SAT or something is attached to the transactions you're making or the wallet that you've reported, right? Like, it can basically say that this transaction has a history that's attached to this UTXO, which is attached to this identity.
I fucking
and it
hate
uses
that.
It uses a centralized server, and I think it checks the email signature based on the person sending it. So your question, like, who's asking for this? I haven't heard anybody ask for this. I know there's been a lot of conversation around decentralized identity, but it has not been a major talking point. It hasn't been something like the businesses or anybody
who's talking
in the industry.
About it, like, who's asking? Like, I think about the big Bitcoin shows. Like, McCormick is the closest guy who would have something like this on his show. It's not there. You know, BTC sessions, why are we bullish? I could go back in the archives. No one's reason for being bullish is digital fucking identity on Bitcoin. You know what I mean? Like, no one's selling this as like a great idea for Bitcoin. And yet here we are.
And then it goes back to the who's asking for this. So who are his customers? I don't know any MicroStrategy customers. Like, I don't know what they build software, like intelligent software that's kind of like, it just looks at all this enterprise software and it creates some sort of pattern or data analysis or inference. I don't know. I don't know who uses that. I've never heard anybody using that.
Sounds like $1 billion to me. I don't know.
Yeah. The timing of the announcement comes when it's like the government has just recently posted about if you don't use KYC, if you're using like peer-to-peer platforms, unreal. You may lose all of your funds if there's some sort of law enforcement incident or like where they investigate a platform or they take over a platform. If he's not a spook, he needs a better PR guy, I guess is what the takeaway is for that for me.
Yeah, what about you, Mike? Where do you come down on this?
I mean, what you just described, I didn't even realize how deep that goes. So I was trying to formulate a bunch of different side threads, but if Sailor is doing this thing and working for some kind of, you know, three-letter acronym government, you know, agent, then like, what does that mean for the rest of us? Does that mean there's like a Sailor's coins and then there's a fork of the non-Sailor's coins protocol? Is that what we're...
Look,
you brought up some interesting stuff is all I'm saying.
No, you're right. And I think the other thing too, you know, it was only like a week ago. It seems like a lifetime at this point because of all the stuff that's happened in the last 7 or 10 days. But Odell and Sailor, you know, kind of going at it, a bit anyways on Twitter about open source development and supporting open source development and Sailor's not giving anything to open source developers and is telling other people not to. Don't you feel a little bit better about that now? Like, do you really want this guy donating his money or time or resources to open source devs to, you know, what, push them in a direction that leads to more of this and less, you know, less of the cypherpunk ethos that really got us here? There's a lot to break down there. Like, it's a hard thing to talk about because it's so early still, but
yeah,
I'm sure that once we watch a little bit more, like what this guy said today and some of the reaction
from
people.
Is this like a new block size war?
I don't know. I don't know what to call
it.
There's so much there, right? Like, it's clear that there's a push from government And it's not just the US and Canada, it's everywhere, like all the European Union governments, the UK, you know, it sounds like El Salvador too, by the way. Like, I also don't trust that guy, to be honest with you. There's a push to identify who's got what. And when I ask myself, and like any person with two brain cells to rub together should ask himself, like, why does this person want to know what I have? This entity want to know what I have? It's not so they can, you know, just write it down and not action it. It's because I think at some point something's going to happen and they're going to want a piece of what you got, or they're going to tell you what you can and can't spend what you got on, or where you can and can't go with what you got, or whether you can uproot your family and take what you got with you. And it's that whole, the focus on what I got is making me uncomfortable, quite honestly. If I'm being, you know, genuine about it, it's a little bit frightening to me that it seems like everyone everywhere at the same time is coming down there's like an intense scrutiny all of a sudden on who's got what Bitcoin, where is it, tie it to your ID, don't use anything that's not KYC. I don't like it. I don't like it one bit.
Is it a PSYOP? Or is it a so I guess it's not a PSYOP. So they are arresting people. They are making policy. It is, but it's, you got to remember, it's also an election year. It is at a time where it seems like the government is losing control in a lot of different areas, whether it's foreign policy, domestic policy, inflation, the market. Everything was going so great. The market was in a bull market leading up to the election, and all of that sudden, that's, you know, there's no rate hikes on the table anymore. Now they're talking about maybe we should rate cuts on the table. Now they're talking maybe we should rate hike. And it seems like they're lashing out. They're trying to gain control. But up until this point, this government, at least the Biden administration and, you know, the different Congress drama and debacles, they haven't demonstrated they really have much of an ability to execute or to be in control. So is this a bluff? Is it a spoof? I don't know. But it's like, we're not going to find this out tomorrow. We're not going to be able to litigate this today. It's going to play out. But when it comes to the Saylor thing, to maybe kind of wrap up my thoughts about it, it's like, I don't know. I'm not like a conspiracy. I don't think he's a CIA. I don't think he's a Fed necessarily, like working for the federal government, so to speak. Maybe he is, though. I don't know. My point is, though, like with all conspiracies, the reason people have these conspiracies is because the media or the individual or the organization is not doing its job and being transparent or like explaining what's going on. And if they did a good job of being more transparent and just honest and just covering the right news, we would have a lot less room to just come up with all these crazy like possible scenarios for what's really going on.
I don't know, man. I agree with part of that. I disagree with the other part. I think Saylor, I'm not convinced he's not in, you know, in it to win it with, you know, Sleepy Joe and the boys there. The only reason I say that is because, you know, you guys do a podcast every week. Len and I, your words on mine, do 10 episodes a week. Not true. We do like 2 or 3 max. My wife would kill me. But like the thing I would say is that you can always get a guest. You know, it's not that hard to get a guest, whether it's a,
right. That's,
you know,
true.
A guy like Pish, or a guy like Jeff Booth, or a guy like me, or guys like you, or guy like, someone is always like, yeah, I got a couple of beers in an hour and a half. Let's shoot the shit about Bitcoin. No one else wants to talk to me about it. Why wouldn't I talk to you about it? Saylor, if you look at his appearances, he had one really crash and burn podcast appearance, I thought, with Marty Bent about 3 years ago when he first came on the scene. And since then, he only goes on podcasts for which he can basically deliver, or during which he can basically deliver a prepared statement with very little interaction with the host. Great example is the recent one he did with Levera. Stefan Levera is a smart fucking dude, man. He knows his shit technically. He knows the economics of Bitcoin. He understands the background in terms of the, you know, shortcomings of Keynesian economics and this sort of superiority of the Austrian school, all this stuff. He's a great guy to talk to, and he knows a lot of stuff about a lot of things. He didn't talk for 2.5 hours while Mike Saylor stood on the pedestal and recited what he had on his stone tablets. This is the nature of a lot of his appearances now. And it makes me wonder if he's like really just doing controlled messaging in a lot of ways. Like, he wants to push something in Bitcoin. He will not talk to you about anything else that day. He will not talk to you about anything that's off the script. He will not make off-script appearances. You never see him in any other content, basically, besides the stuff where he's offering long form, 2, 3, sometimes 4 hour, stuff that you need to listen to 2 or 3 times to really digest everything. That gives me pause because like I was saying before, a lot of people probably want to talk to him. And I would guess that not a lot of people in fucking software pattern recognition are like, yeah, let's get Mike on the show to talk about what he's doing in software. No fucking way. People want to talk to him about Bitcoin. And yet the guy is just impossible to get. He's impossible to get. He is impossible to get. And I would just, you know, I would ask the question, why is that? You know, every other big name seems to want to do podcasts of basically any size, as long as they're Bitcoin focused. But this guy doesn't want to. I realize he's got a board that he's got to appease. I realize there's some fiduciary responsibilities he has that maybe you guys don't have and I don't have and some others don't have. But at the same time, is there a better way to pump your bags than to unite the Bitcoin crowd behind a cause and do so in a way that's relatable and, you know, it's like a frequent thing you do, you get more touch points? He doesn't do any of that. Instead, it's like a very much a controlled press kind of strategy that he's employing.
Right.
That also is a little bit like, you know, so I'm not there. I don't know what, but I don't like that either, to be honest with you.
So what is your take, or like, what is your theory on how he feels about Bitcoin? I mean, he's got a lot of it. He's buying it, keeps buying it. So he's invested in it, but obviously, first of all, disclaimer, you should never expect that any billionaire or like industry tycoon is thinking I got to make sure I'm doing what's right by the plebs. That's not what they're doing. So like maybe if you thought like, you know, sailors pumping the price, like we're all in this together. Okay, sure. Like if that's fun for you, awesome.
Oh man. Yeah.
But what do you think his end goal or his end game is? He doesn't have, and people have talked about this before. We talked about this on the show. He doesn't have a family. Doesn't have kids.
Oh,
he doesn't have this generational wealth to pass on. He's not going to have like a sailor institutes and like his family running them generations from now. So, how do you think he's looking at it? What's his end game?
Man, that's a good question. How about, I mean, let's think about what he's said in the last few years about Bitcoin development, right? We talked about how he doesn't want to give to core devs or open source development projects. Fine. I'm glad about that. Although I don't think for the same reason that he is. I don't think he's in it long term. I really don't. I think he's like in it for the cash, the fiat gains. He's ultimately the CEO of a company that he's spent, you know, what, 5x the amount of time, 10x the amount of time with than he spends in Bitcoin. And the other reason I think that he's not in it to win it for the long term is, you know, I think like 2 or 3 years ago, he did an interview about, and this is sort of in relation to the open source development comments that he made or didn't make, I guess, along with the contributions he didn't make. He thinks Bitcoin should ossify. And he talks about how the network is kind of sound as it is. We don't need to improve it. It's store of value. It's digital gold. It's going to win anyway. Let's not, you know, do something that's, you know, whimsical for the sake of appeasing some, you know, trendy thing in the moment and destroy this beautiful network that we have, right? I don't know how I feel about, like, you know, every single improvement request or improvement proposal getting implemented, but to say that you should ossify now at a time when tech in every silo, in every discipline is moving faster than ever before is stupid. Like, it's a stupid thing to say unless you only care about not giving up the gains that you think you've already basically locked in, just because the other side of the equation, right? If you think about this like a math equation, you know, Bitcoin is on one side. The other side of the equation is all the money laundering governments do, all the war, all the printing, the inflation, you know, a number of geriatrics and bow ties telling you that everything is fine, everything's good. If that's the other side of the equation, you don't have to do anything to your side of the equal sign. You can sit and you'll grow. And because he's got so much of the available supply, he's golden, man. Whether he wants to give it to his kids, his mistress, some guy on the street in an open dime, you know, it doesn't matter. He's going to be fine. And I think that it's it's starting to look like that's all he cares about. We'll see what this ID thing looks like. We'll see if he changes his mind on open source devs or why he did that or didn't do that, I should say. But to me, like, you know, I don't think he's in it for the long term. That's another thing that worries me a bit. I'm not saying that I'm one of these people who's like, you know, Bitcoin's going to be around 1,000 years from now. That's just as stupid to say, I think, as to say that we have to ossify it. You don't know what anything is going to look like 1,000 years from now. You know, 5 years from now is hard to predict. November for you guys over there is hard to predict, let alone, you know, 10 centuries away. But I just, all this stuff together, it paints a picture that he's not really as long-term a thinker when it comes to the value of Bitcoin as he would have you believe. And I think, honestly, that's a shortcoming in the Bitcoin crowd, right? We really attached ourselves to this guy when he came on the scene. And fuck me if that wasn't a mistake. It's showing now. I think it's going to become a clear mistake for a lot of people. But, the, you know, this burn your heroes thing that Bitcoin embraces, we're going to see how much it really means to people, I think, in the next year or so. I wouldn't be surprised if he was a key figure in that determination.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely going to be a lot of battling over what Bitcoin becomes or what Bitcoin is. I think with Roger Ver also being in the news lately, in Mike's question about, is this another big block wars or block size war type of event or, you know, culmination? Is this what we're building up to? And I think potentially, I don't know exactly what it's going to be over. It seems like it's going to have something to do with UTXOs, identity, KYC, like privacy. It's coming down to something there. I don't know if it'll be a bigger meme to rally around. But one of the lessons of the block size war was that Bitcoin is hard to change. So if you're trying to raise the block size limit or you're trying to, you have to hard fork and then the network that hard forks off, it can't compete, right? Or at least the ones that have tried have not come close. But I think there's another lesson that is, or a different perspective on it, that is also just as important, or it's what I'm thinking about lately. And I think that Roger Ver learned this one as well, which is that Bitcoin is hard to prevent from changing. Mm-hmm. So what his idea of Bitcoin was, it started to diverge from that. And he tried to prevent that from happening, and he couldn't. So then he tried to fork it off and do his own thing. And the BSV people did similar things. I'm wondering right now if we're coming to a turning point where it's not that somebody is necessarily going to do another hard fork, but it's that people who are trying to, whether it's covenants, whether it's just like L enhance, or maybe it's something in the future, it's just the people who don't want to ossify versus the people who want to ossify, the people who don't want to let it change, or don't like how the culture is changing, don't like how the media is changing, don't like the ETFs, they don't like what's happening to Bitcoin, and they're concerned. And it's like, how do you approach it? Like, is it coming down to essentially what it's going to be? The block size war is just now, is Bitcoin's direction going forward. Is it MOE? Is it a database? Is it store of value? Who are the camps? Who are the sides? I don't think we have a clear picture yet.
Can I just add, and how long is that war?
Right.
Oh, man. I mean, think.
And when
think
did it
about,
start?
Yes, it started 10 years ago. And, you know, one of the things I say on our show all the time is that the strategy for governments has never changed. There's never been a fresh coat of paint. There's never been a, you know, KPMG consulting session to review some of the, you know, SWOT analysis. It's a terrible strategy. But the thing that the government always had in its pocket was narrative control. And the thing that they're struggling with now is no one believes them all of a sudden. And it may not seem suddenly for guys like us, but for the normie crowd, I think that they've lost, you know, a significant portion of the influence they had vis-a-vis, you know, MSNBC and over here the CBC. You know, we have these media organizations that are basically nothing but state stenographers, and they're sort of architects of these government narratives. In terms of like when the war started, the reason I bring this up is because if you think back to Bitcoin's early days, there wasn't much commentary from the big media outlets, big media orgs, short of it's tulips, it's a fad, don't invest in it, you'll lose all your money, you'll lose your shirt. Okay, fine. 2016, 17, you start hitting five-figure value for Bitcoin, you get 10 and 20K, or just try 20K, whatever that number ended up being. and the government's saying, well, something here, you know, or the news orgs are saying, oh, there's something here, but it's still a fad. It's tulips. It's never going to amount to anything. There's a lot of scams. Be careful. And I swear to God, like the number of times you don't see, this is something I think about a lot, and it's been happening since 2017. The number of times you know that like a crime happened in your city and you don't get all the details because it doesn't fit a certain narrative or doesn't fit a certain worldview. But during crypto bull runs, you literally hear about every Dick, Harry, and Jane who lost $5 in a Nigerian prince phone scam thanks to Bitcoin. That tells you something, you know, like there's really something there that there's an intent and a focus making sure that everyone hears about these stories related to Bitcoin and crypto even more broadly. How long is the attack going to last? I don't know. I think that there's a lot of people who believe that the attack is sort of climaxing now. I would say we're still in the foreplay stage of the attack personally. And the reason I say that is because you can still self-custody your Bitcoin. There's no problem there. You know, companies up here in Canada are still doing KYC-free Bitcoin buys, finding loopholes in different, you know, regulations and money transmitter stuff and all that. And do I think it's going to be like a fight for the soul of Bitcoin? I can't remember who said that recently. I hate that phrase, but it's right. good phrase here. No, I don't think it is. I'd be curious, you know, I don't hear a lot of people talking about the ETFs and the sort of Bitcoin podcast space in terms of like, are they good or bad? I think a lot of people just talk about like, yeah, the price.
Everybody likes
up,
to avoid demand. That question.
Yeah. Why though? Like, do you guys think they're good or bad? I know Len hates them and I don't agree with Len and him and I don't agree on a bunch of stuff, but you know, we still do the show together. Do you guys feel, you know, passionately one way or the other?
Before I, Mike, go ahead. Do you have an answer to that yet?
The way I feel about ETFs?
Yeah.
Look, to be honest, I'm a man that needs to learn more about the thing that I've invested in.
Okay.
And so I cannot speak.
But that's fine. You're at least honest ETFs. About it, right?
I don't know what it is, you know? I don't know, right. I don't know where it exists or where I live.
My answer is the same, and this may be a good segue into talking about your conversation with David and Mark from Bitcoin Magazine and like the drama around that. I have the same answer as David Bailey. It's inevitable. It was inevitable. It doesn't matter what I think about it. It doesn't matter if I think it's good. It doesn't matter if I think it's bad. However, I am very wary of the influence it will have. I'm very wary of its impact on how they're going to affect, you know, the way the judicial system treats it, how it's going to impact if you don't have KYC, like your ability to use on-ramps, off-ramps, anything that's connected to the ETFs.
So tell me what you think. Like, give me some, right. Give me the 30,000 foot on like the judicial system and Bitcoin through the lens of the ETF. I need to hear it. No one's talking about it. So tell me what you think.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll dovetail into that because I think that all the reasons that it is bad is being covered by influencers. It's by contrarians, by writers, authors. People are talking about why it's a bad thing or why they're going to potentially try to lock down control. And I agree with those things. Those things are real risks. But I don't think there's also enough people who, yeah, it's bad, but it is inevitable. It's already here. Obviously, we didn't stop it. Mm-hmm. So, but you just have to adjust from this point and start. How do you take back control or assert your sovereignty on chain in this new paradigm? Because it's here, you didn't get rid of it, it's expanding, it's spreading. So yeah, you can cry about it, but it's that the people who are crying about it, quote unquote, they sound like they've given up. It's fatalistic, like the state's gonna take over Bitcoin. We're not gonna have
6103 Bitcoin,
yada yada yada. Like, yeah, that is a risk. However, it has not completely happened yet, and even if they start to take, you know, action, doesn't mean you can't fight back. What is the plan to fight back? So where do I sit on the ETF? I sit on, yeah, we all seem to agree that it's not the best way to hold Bitcoin. It's not ideal. There's a lot of risks that come with it. How are we going to solve for that? How are we going to put protections in place, build in more features, products, layers, whatever, forks, enhancements, whatever you need to combat this? And that's what I want to hear people talk about, because I think if you're looking at the news today, right, they took down Samurai, they're going after people,
yeah,
they're finding out ways to just eliminate privacy, even if you didn't buy from a KYC exchange. Like, if you have any significant amount of Bitcoin, they can start to track you and eventually tie your identity to this cluster they've been tracking. All this risk is there. We're never going to get rid of this risk. The risk is only going to get worse and worse and more and more as it becomes more valuable, as more government agencies are looking at this and using it every day. What are we going to do about it? What is the action? That's what I wish more people would talk about.
It's a weird, there's a number of moving parts there, right? I think the thing that I have the highest hope for in terms of Bitcoin winning, and a lot of things winning, honestly, like, you know, strong communities and strong men winning in the long term, even the short and medium term, to some extent, there's going to be too many people that realize something is wrong with the system in which they're operating. And as you force more people to go down with the ship, more people are going to realize that the ship is sinking. And right now we're not quite there. I mean, there's still talk about, you know, 2% inflation up here. You guys just had Powell talking today about, you know, inflation is regulating, but not as fast as they want. And he's still pretty dovish compared to what the data looks like. And people are kind of, you know, they're sleepwalking a bit. But I think as time goes on, people will realize that, man, you know, it's been 6 years since COVID, and the, you know, box of cereal that I used to get for $3 is, you know, $8. It says family size, but it's only 200 grams more than it was, you know, 5 years ago. I don't understand, like, what happened here. There's obviously, like, a shortcoming in what I'm being told. There's a gap in the story here somewhere. As more people understand that, Bitcoin succeeds even if they don't hold it, because those people will become of the same mindset that we are. In terms of, like, this whole thing being broken. That's number one. Number two, as far as the ETFs, look, I've said before, and it's funny, I do semi-regular appearances on this, like, big Canadian boomer economic show called Money Talks. I really like the host, Mike Campbell. He's a great guy. He's done our show. And one of the things I say to him that I think resonates with some of the Bitcoin crowd, at least, it certainly resonates with the boomers, is, look, you know, whether you think Bitcoin is the answer or not, we agree on almost everything else. You may view it as real estate or gold or whatever, that's the solution, but you know you can't stay in cash. And, you know, the ETFs, what they do is they bring on the fringe edge cases that would never have bought Bitcoin at Swan. Like my father, right, only has Bitcoin because I introduced him to it, but his friends may not ever go to Bull Bitcoin or ShakePay up here or Swan or Coinbase or whatever. They're not going to go and buy and custody and all these things. They're not even going to use, like, Coinbase wallet or keep it on exchange. All those things are never going to be possible for them. But what they might do is have a tax-advantaged account where, you know, you have, like, a fixed income ETF that now has 1% or 2% Bitcoin, which Fidelity has up here. There's a Fidelity ETF up here that has 1% or 2% allocation to Bitcoin and fixed income. No one who has a fixed income ETF is looking at the breakdown of the holdings quarter over quarter to see if they added Bitcoin. They don't care. It's
right,
managed through their bank or through their broker or through a family office, whatever. And so you get some price improvement there. Ultimately, and it sucks to say this because I do think that there's a lot of Bitcoiners who have become, like, pure think boy Puritans. The number go up matters a lot, man, because you need new money to pump the price. We can't just keep selling to each other and buying from each other. We need new people to come into the system for the number to go up. And if the number goes up, you get more support and you get more attention and you get more eyes and you get more interest and you get more adoption. That those things come together. I don't think there's a chicken and egg thing there like some Bitcoiners do. I think it's very clear what the driving force there is. So for me, the ETFs overall net positive. Do I think, like, you know, Dave said yesterday that it's like an inevitable rug? I don't know. I think, much like people say, like, the inevitable rug thing, I view as almost in the same light as people who say, like, well, you can't, Bitcoin mining is going to fail when quantum computing starts. My brother in Christ, if quantum computing comes around, the mining algo is going to be like number 1,000 on the list of things that are affecting you day to day. Don't worry about that.
Right.
The same way that
it's like the good people saying, like, if an asteroid hits the world,
yeah.
it stings all but a million of us, you and know, there's no like, internet. Or it's like, well, if that happens,
good luck. Yeah, you'll be eating out of a tuna can and killing your neighbors for their flesh and blood. Exactly.
Right, I don't care about my Bitcoin.
And so, like, you know, the much the same way, I can't imagine the government, especially the American government, to its own people saying, we're going to either take or mark to market at a rate that we decide is fair all your Bitcoin and all these ETFs. Thanks for playing. Good luck. Because if that happens, like, the rule of law is so diminished at that point that,
yeah,
you know, you're living in a society where it's not a democratic sort of first world country. And by the way, some Bitcoiners would hear that statement and say, well, are we not sliding this way already? Look at San Francisco, look at university campuses today, look at, you know, XYZ in the United States or Canada. You're already seeing this, you know, people bent over high on fentanyl and all kinds of other stuff. Everywhere, police afraid to do their jobs in the best scenario, and in the worst case scenario, doing their jobs and having activist district attorneys release violent criminals back onto the street because they believe more in rehabilitation than they do in incarceration and punishment. These are deeper questions than, you know, maybe we have time for tonight. But I would just say that there's some argument to be made that the slide is happening. And if you have to pick where you're going to park your assets, are you really going to hold cash in a shoebox? Are you going to hold gold? Or are you going to hope that a global internet and game theory that's in history, I think, unprecedented in terms of like the just clean lines driving the outcomes, is that where you want to park it? I think you'd be wise to at least have some there, and more people are coming around to that. I think the ETFs are playing a part.
I think, honestly, I think that... Go ahead, Mike.
No, I was going to ask you, do you want to park it in Sailor's Bitcoin or in the new Bitcoin?
Yeah. We got to find out what the fork's called. How many good tickers are left? There can't be that many.
Yeah. I think that what you said, I probably agree with 99% of what you said. I think that's very logical. I think it's a very practical approach to the question. But to play devil's advocate, or just to not really take a position, but just leave it with a question, would be, yes, number go up is important. I agree with that. I think everybody does. That's how you get into Bitcoin. But is number go up so important, or are we willing to deal with and accept all the trade-offs that we're being asked to make about how to use Bitcoin, about how to be considered lawful or not have to be on the run from the government, or however they treat it for taxes, or if you could have it in your retirement account, yada, yada, yada. All of these trade-offs that we're making so that a bunch of boomers who don't care about it, who don't have any real, they don't give any thought to it. They don't care if it really succeeds or fails. They're happy if they even know that it's in their BlackRock or Fidelity ETF package, like blended portfolio that they own. Like, yeah, they're benefiting from it. Because the world's falling apart or because there's inflation. But am I willing to make all these trade-offs so that this person who doesn't care about it gets to benefit from it? And I don't know if I am. If the number goes up to like 500,000, I might readjust how much I'm willing to tolerate, right? Everybody's willing to tolerate a certain amount.
Yeah.
But that is a different answer or different for everybody. So everybody's got to make that decision for themselves.
There's no perfect solution. There's only trade-offs, right? Who says that? Some Twitter economist, I don't know who, but
right.
You know, like when I
an influencer.
Yeah, for sure. Some influencer. I'm going to start selling those Zen pouches, and call myself a Zen influencer. I've been meaning to do something about that on Twitter, but I don't do Zens, nor do I have another burner.
Next time I see Lynn Alden, I just want to ask her if I can Zen Alden. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Anyway, look, to your point there, to your question, I think it's a good question. There's no trade-offs or no solutions, only trade-offs, number one. Number two, like, you have to, have you guys read Sovereign Individual? You must have by now.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So like the thing I always talk about when this question comes up about taxes, I always say people are always looking for like these signposts of governments that are failing, right? They're losing their grip on power and losing their grip on sort of civil and civilized society and civilized people. Everyone is looking for stuff like BLM riots or rigged elections or, cost of living crises. I would say you need to be looking at tax regimes. If the tax regime is starting to look a little outrageous, even to, like, you know, your favorite socialist friend, then what you are seeing is the end stages of a democracy, because it does two things, right? It does the one thing it does is control capital flight, and the other thing it does is prevent a new sort of bourgeoisie from emerging via wealth accumulation. And to me, when I see stuff like, we're not going to let you use this a certain way, you have to pay capital gains on it. In Canada, starting next year, if the budget passes — the budget was tabled 2 weeks ago, I think, at this point — if the budget passes, you not only have to report your Bitcoin and crypto sales, you have to report your Bitcoin and crypto buys, which is, like, you know, that's a signpost. And, you know, you guys did the same thing we did with the significant jump or proposed jump in capital gains taxes and the inclusion rate and stuff like that. And so when I see that, I think to myself, like, these guys are not long for this world now. The policies are not long for this world, because people won't stand for it. The productive class will not allow this to continue. The BlackRocks, the Fidelities, the Vanguards, you know, they will not allow this to continue. They will not give their money to governments to spend it on pet projects and, you know, putting, you know, how many more billion
Europeans
dollars.
Do.
They don't really, though. It's American money, not European
you're right.
money.
You're right.
And
you're
so, like, you know, when I think about the European war effort right now, you have, I think you guys are paying all the Ukrainian civil service pensions and salaries. And yeah. I think you just sent — I say you, it's really the royal you. Obviously, you two don't support this kind of stuff. But, you know, that you sent another $60 billion over there. You got to be close to 1 million or 750,000 young Ukrainian men through the meat grinder at this point for a war that, you know, any Age of Empires 3 or 4 player would have told you was unwinnable 3 years ago. And, you know, at some point, like I said before, when it comes to narrative, people will wake up and be like, yeah, I'm not going to stand for this. The other thing is that you have to imagine that Bitcoin, for all the positives and potential that it has, how high is it really on the list of things the American government's worried about in terms of its citizens using it in ways that are detrimental to the dollar, to the stability of the country? It can't be that high on the list. And so if it happens to Bitcoin, the other thing you should be looking at is, where else is it happening that I just don't pay any attention to? Real estate is one thing. It's starting to happen here. I don't know what it would be for you guys.
Yeah, here
but
too,
here it's
for
a
sure.
big deal. Is it? Yeah. So like, you see this
it's
more
not
and more.
As bad as Canada. It's not as bad as Toronto. I know that. But I mean, maybe, you know, only because places like San Francisco and a few others, the commercial real estate sector is imploding so badly that it's kind of bringing everything down and kind of keeping it at, like, a certain level. And plus, you guys are doing way crazier shit to, like, subsidize first-time buyers and give people longer mortgages.
Did you see this thing that came out last week? I don't know if Len was on, like, a month ago with you guys, so you definitely didn't talk about it. But we just up here, like I said, our finance minister tabled the budget, and included in the budget were measures — you know, these are her words, not mine — measures to improve the affordability for first-time homebuyers. Among them, extending amortizations to 35 years in some cases for the first-time homebuyer. 5 years.
That's coming here.
At least 40 years,
I'm saying.
You think that's long? Just wait till I give you the context. 35 years, you can also now take up to $60,000 or $100,000 for couples out of your retirement accounts to fund your first-time home. So you work until you die. You pull your retirement. The best part is that in 2022 or 2021, the average age for a Canadian to buy their first home was 36. What is it now? Probably 38, 39, let's say, with the recent run-up in home prices here. So you're going to work to pay off your mortgage till you're 74, and then you will have pulled the 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 or $100,000 out of your mortgage that would have compounded the most intensely for your entire working career and not have it at the end. It's insane. And then when you can't live at 80, you know, they'll just suggest that you kill yourself.
Yeah, right.
The Canadian dream, right? It's truly incredible. And you know, it's not as intense there, but it may become that intense. I don't know. You guys have your own set of problems. I'd be curious to hear where you guys come down and what's going on over there.
So if you look back.
That was intense, dude. That was intense.
If you look back to the height of the Japanese bubble in the late 80s, early 90s, that they still have not recovered from. They, I think, extended mortgages up to like 70 years to 100 years, maybe.
It's a generational asset.
Right. And at one point in time — I don't know if you know the stat, it's kind of a common stat — but at one point in time, the, like, imperial government palace or whatever in Tokyo, that was, you know, couple of acres in square foot. Well, you guys go by the metric system, but
I don't. We know no, we do square feet,
right? Like but estate, that, but that plot of land was worth more in terms of real estate value than the entire state of California.
Oh god,
which is crazy, right? Like, so they had like this crazy bubble, and they're still dealing with it 30 years later. But here in the United States, right? So the house, the real estate situation and the housing situation is not quite as dire for most people, like especially like in the Midwest and in rural areas, you can get a pretty cheap house. It's a pretty good deal. Texas, even, you can get like huge houses for pretty cheap.
However, tell my wife all the time, we should move to Texas. She doesn't want to hear it, but yeah.
It's warmer there. But what the Canadians I don't think have is like everybody in the millennial generation is carrying around like $50,000, $60,000, $100,000. Some people are carrying around $250,000. A student loan debt. So like they're trying to go get mortgages, and yeah, maybe it's you're not paying $1 million for a 900 square foot house in Toronto, but you're paying $750,000 for it, and you've also got $75,000 to $100,000 of student loan debt, and it's so it's like it's still this debt problem. It's still impossible.
That is your black swan, eh? That student debt thing,
right? I mean,
it's been featured so prominently in the election. I think Corinne Jean-Pierre has probably said debt forgiveness more than she says any other two words at the podium. Yeah.
And I think ultimately the millennials are going to be this kind of up, like in during the fourth turning.
How old are you guys? You guys millennials?
37.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be 37 this 39. Year. Yeah. I'll be 37 this year.
Yeah. So
we're in the same boat.
During the fourth turning, my prediction is one of the outcomes is going to be that millennials basically pull Social Security from the boomers and be like, you have all the assets. You have you lived through the bond, like the perfect that 1980 to 2000, whatever time period. You've got everything. You have way too much money. You squandered your wealth. You're not giving it to your kids. That's a weird thing that boomers do in the United States, too, is they don't pass their wealth on to their family. They just give it all to charity. Yeah, that's a huge thing. Like Warren Buffett here in Omaha.
Yeah, Buffett is one thing, but like kids, your parents actors. Are not fucking giving it to, you know, Ronald McDonald.
It's a big problem
here,
right? It's
really?
A boomer thing. Yeah, it's a terrible like.
Wow.
Thing. So I think we're just gonna say Social Security, Medicare, you don't get it. It's done. Sorry, rugged. And we're gonna use that to pay off our student loans.
Is it interesting to you guys that, like, when I hear stuff like that, if you like break it down to brass tacks, all I hear is the have-nots are going to so severely outnumber the haves pretty soon that everything they have will just be voted away from them, if you know, whatever.
Generational thing. It's going to be the millennials rugging the boomers. Because the boomers have been the selfish, reckless generation in American history.
The people underneath us are going to do it too, because they have even less than us. Like the Zoomers have so little. These guys are literally just going home, jerking off into the pillow, watching Netflix, farting, and going to sleep, and then going to the work again at, you know, at some Amazon warehouse the next day. They're going to for sure vote to take your tax advantaged savings account. Like that's the next thing on the list, right? They're going to take it from you at some point. And as that continues to happen, like this is the thing I fear. And I'd be curious what you guys think about it, because I know the Americans are much more passionate about like the sort of democratic values than we are. I think people look at the system we have. And when I think about like millennials voting to take boomer Social Security away, it's frustrating to me because the boomers did what any sort of competent generation would do. They protected their wealth the best way they knew how. They knew that money wasn't the answer, that cash wasn't the answer. They had to do something. So they did real estate or they did whatever, right? We're doing it as well with the tax advantage stuff and Bitcoin, maybe some real estate. As generations underneath vote away or vote to take away those advantages and sort of bestow them on themselves, I think a lot of the rationale is, man, look, this system that we had, the capitalist system or whatever, is failing. I think honestly though, the system that is failing is democracy. And the problem is that you have too many people who have no skin in the game, didn't do the right things, not because they wouldn't have, but because they never had the opportunity to, saying that the people who did have the opportunity and did do the right things owe it to them to give it all away or lose some of the advantage. I don't know what the fix for that is. That's the thing I think is coming soon. Like people are going to realize in Canada, you're seeing this with immigration. You guys have a similar problem, maybe not quite the scale that we have, but like the ruling parties will just import people who will vote for Social Security, and that's Social Security.
Oh, that's one of the biggest. That's one of the biggest issues going on in the U.S. right now.
It's got to come from somewhere, right? You know, it's coming from us. It's coming from our parents. It's coming from whoever. And so I just think that like there's something to be discussed there. There's a debate to be had, an honest debate about which system really is leaving us with these problems. Is it capitalism or is it democracy? I don't know where I sit on that. If you had said this to 20-year-old me, no way, right? I would have said, no, capitalism is more of a problem. But now I'm not so sure.
No, I think you make a lot of good points. I guess where I'm coming from is that if you look, I don't think it's just narrowed down to like millennials in America versus boomers in America. I think you are looking at the rest of the world coming to the realization, or at least in the West, the younger people looking at the boomers as, I mean, what did the boomers do? They took us from the like very affluent, successful trajectory. We were on the gold standard, all this yada, yada, yada in the post-war, World War II era.
Mm-hmm.
And that the boomer generation, once they took control, put humanity through the U.S. national debt into like they ran up the credit card to levels never before seen in history, not just affecting young Americans, although we're hit pretty hard. This is fucking everybody else in the world. And they did it all. They ran up the credit card for, you know, somebody else got to pay it after we're dead. They did it to like finance their successful, comfortable, plush lives.
Yeah.
And then when COVID came, they supported the government putting everybody on lockdown and injecting them and like saying, if you leave the house, you're going to get beat with batons because if I'm 65 years old, I have a higher risk of dying from COVID. So if you leave your house, you got to get beat.
Yeah.
And you're locked down and we're going to keep running up the credit card so that my house and my properties and my Airbnbs in Florida and my fucking Teslas and my 7-car garages, like that I'm not going to give any of that. I'm not giving this to my kids when I die. I'm going to donate it to the Bill Gates Foundation.
I can't believe that.
And people are seeing that and they're like, I don't know how much more leeway we're going to give these boomers, because like they say things like, you know, show some responsibility, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, save your money, stop eating avocado toast, you know, you should fight for your country, should be patriotic. Like, you guys are the ones that were dodging the Vietnam War. You guys went to Canada. A bunch of American boomers went to Canada so they didn't have to go fight in the war. I wouldn't want to fight in the war either, but if I left the country to dodge the draft, I wouldn't be, you know, preaching about hypocrisy and like telling people that they should, you know, defend their country and be patriotic, or, you know, deal with inflation or whatever it is. I'm just saying people are going to be mad at boomers. So it's a tough situation. It feels like it's starting to boil.
It is. That's a big problem, right? There's a number of fault lines, I think, that sort of naturally exist in big democracies, I'll say it because I think it's probably true. Between like racial groups, cultural groups, age groups, different demographics, you name it, right? These are natural fault lines. There's nothing wrong with these fault lines, and there's ways to make them work. There's ways to make them not only work, but to have a society flourish using some of those differences to build like a stronger, cohesive group that's able to move forward generation after generation and get stronger. The problem is when those fault lines are no longer papered over by economic success, people become tribal. We see this all the time, right? And it's not unnatural to have those feelings. Like, I need to stick with my neighborhood, need to stick with my family, need to stick with people who are the same color as me, same religion as me, same whatever. The problem is, it's hard to come back from that, man, if you don't have the opportunity for growth and prosperity. And Canada's seeing that. You guys are seeing it. I think Europe, like, I don't consume a lot of European news, but I think they're really having a hard time with that over there. And you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot going on that we don't see firsthand, but it's concerning to me. You know, the other thing that's a little bit worrying is that I think it's clear that this stuff is going on in a lot of different places and we don't see exactly how much of it. And by the time it becomes obvious that this is a problem, with all the attempts that are being made to suppress that information, it's going to be way too late to do anything about it. That's another fear that I have. You know, we're going to go down this road where we didn't do anything all the way through, tried to hide it from each other, hoping it would just kind of go away, or we could inflate our way out of the economic problems or whatever. And, you know, but when it becomes obvious there's a problem, it's too late, right? The cancer is stage 4 and you're just, you know, you're a ticking time bomb at that point.
For sure. No, that's a lot to unfold. Go ahead, Mike.
You know, I've been enjoying so much these topics that I want to continue a lot. But I do want to say a joke before I forget it that you guys made me think about.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, it relates a little bit to like clown world. And I know that you have like a clown world take on your show, right?
It's called Notable News now. Thank you very much. But yeah, it's where we throw in some of the, you know, more outlandish stories of the day.
You're like familiarizing people with what clown world is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it made me think about this like jokey world. And I was like, you know, I always thought Trump was such like a joke president, right?
A meme president, yeah. Yeah. Like just a clown.
Yeah, such a joke clowny president.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when Biden came in, he took the joke too far.
Oh, yeah. Yo, yeah, I...
That's the joke.
But it's true. I mean, how can people were upset that this guy, you know, when DJT won the election, a lot of people were upset about his sort of demeanor, decorum. But I think any sensible person now would trade him for what you see in the staff and the sort of, you know, global. I mean, I don't have a lot of room to pull punches here, obviously, up here in Canada, but I would much rather have Donald than Biden. And I think the election this year, like, I'd be curious to hear what you guys think, because a lot of the guests we have on the show who are from the States, on air or off air, are expressing a lot of concern about what November is going to look like. Their safety, yeah. Their family safety, the safety of sort of the democratic institutions that you guys have built over the last several hundred years. I don't know what to make of it, but it's clearly like a, you know, powder keg over there. And you got one guy who's, I mean, asleep at the wheel is not a strong enough phrase. And the other guy is just, he's a bulldozer, right? And so I don't know how much Adderall and Molly can you give Joe Biden for, you know, 2 hours of debating in November? I'm not sure. But is it enough to like convince people that he could win an election? And then, you know, I'd also be curious to hear, not that I'm conducting the interview, but I'd also be curious to hear that, you know, what you guys think about the sort of sanctity of the elections over there. Because a lot of people here are like, I don't know anymore. I'm not 100% sure. Everyone sees the mail-in thing and it's weird. Our prime minister, the ruling party here, just said that they want to introduce electoral reforms to make the elections 3 days long here. So like a lot of people now are starting to ask these questions, like why? We did this for so long. The technology's better now. Why do I have to go to the polls for 3 days?
I think that the question about the last election, was it legit or any of the elections legit? I don't know. I think that the incentive is there to cheat. However, especially with the mail-in stuff.
And
we shouldn't say that
just one party cheated. Like,
no, of course. Everybody
would be cheating. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everybody does it. Yeah. I don't know that it's like blatant. I don't know if the definition is there. Like, there's anything you could have in court or any piece of evidence that would convince the people. Like, because it's like you could have evidence of a lot of things, and people will just like not care. But like that's not enough for me to say that this is whatever, you know? So I don't know if he could, you know, if Trump could even ever prove it and if it's worth his time to try. But I do think that in 2020, a lot of people, whether they were, you know, however they swung politically, just thought that a vote for Biden would be like a vote for going back to normal. It had been a very crazy year. COVID was insane. People were traumatized.
Yeah.
And I think people just thought that if they voted for him, things would go back to normal. Little did we know, according to my, based on Mike's joke, that it was only going to get crazier, way crazier. And I think now people are like, all right, maybe looking back, it wasn't so bad before. But here's the thing, though. It's not as easy as like, what's the rational or like, what's the common sense choice do you think people are making? And there's like so much trauma and tribalism and like just vicious political back and forth, like culture war going on here, that it's like people, like even the people who are calling Biden a genocidal supporter, like they're gonna vote for him over Trump.
Yeah,
like because they think Trump's worse somehow. And it's so it doesn't matter who wins in November. Half the country is not going to accept that result. They're going to say that it was fixed. They're going to say that it was not fair. They're going to say it was a Russian intervention. They're going to make up, or they're going to say that it was cooked against Trump doesn't matter who wins. There's going to be unrest. It's going to get worse. And I think neither of those two are the right choice. Neither of those two are going to fix anything. I think Trump would probably be a little bit better, like on a lot of issues. But at the end of the day, it's not going to solve the bigger issues. I think so whoever wins this next one, however long they make it into their next term, they're the defining aspect of that term is they're going to be the ones managing the rest of the institutions in the United States crumbling. They're like rule of law, religion, healthcare, everything. It's all falling apart here, and they're just going to oversee it and be the guys doing the spin, and we'll be making memes from it.
Mike, what do you think? Shaking your finger there before about craziness. I mean,
it just sounds so dark. Like it's such a dark journey ahead, guys.
It is.
Well, like this, that's why it's so important to like have strong families, community, stuff like that, right? Like I think anyway, like my wife and I moved to a smallish kind of community in September, and you know, it's not that I don't like it here. I do. But I think, you know, if you told me 5-6 years ago I was going to move here, I would have said, nah, it's boring, it's slow, it's these kinds of things. But as you can kind of see the landscape changing, you want to have a place where like you feel confident people around you are like-minded, and you don't want to be in a situation where you're like, you know, wondering what your neighbors are thinking or wondering if, you know, they're thinking about what you have in your house, what you know, what you have available to them in a dire situation. It's amazing that we're even speaking like this, because I think even 3 years ago during COVID, when the pandemic really started and everyone was kind of on their heels a little bit, there was a broad sense of community I hadn't felt in a long time. And it evaporated so quickly and has continued to deteriorate for the last 4 years at a pace that even surprises, I think, a lot of doomers. You know, I don't think anyone thought that we'd be talking about legitimacy of elections and accepting election results in a place like the United States in 2024. Two elections ago, you had Hillary talking about how Russia was, interfering. But the Obama-Romney in 2012, this was... And no one was talking about anything like this. It was nowhere. And 10 years later now, you're talking about managing basically a revolt of half of the United States. Insane inertia on that front.
Gradually, then suddenly.
Yeah. Great point. Great point.
Well, I mean, there is just so many other things to go to, but I do want to be respectful of everyone's time. And so I will ask you, Joey, was there anything you wanted to speak about specifically? And do you have to get to your podcast?
No, I don't care about my plugging my podcast. I want to know what you guys thought about the David Bailey, Mark Goodwin, interview.
Yes, that's what yesterday. I wanted to end with. That's what I wanted to end with.
That's great.
Okay, so I'll tell you, let me give your listeners a bit of context because.
Let me ask real quick first.
Sure.
Did Len really, boycott that or was that a joke?
He boycotted.
Okay, okay. Yeah. All right, that's, I just wanted to not go into
it. I will read you, I'm going to read you a message from one of the groups we're in, because only he could speak.
And the chat, the people in the chat were pretty antagonistic towards David and Mark. Mostly
David. They didn't like it. Let me find where he said this. Let me see. He didn't like it at all. Him and I don't agree on everything, as you can imagine. But, geez, where did he write this thing? He basically said, like, I'm not going to go to the interview. I'm not going to go to the chat. I'm not going to waste my time. I think those guys are scammers. They're not worth a second. You know, my time is precious. It's valuable. I'm not going to give any of it to these con artists. Which, you know, I disagree with. We'll get to the interview. You guys can ask me whatever you want, and I'll answer it as honestly as I can. But I will just say that difference of opinion, both when we're doing the show with the guest and when we're doing the Monday shows with each other, is what makes the show good. And if I always agreed with everything he said and he always agreed with everything I said, it would be so fucking boring for both of us and for everyone who listens and watches. And by the way, that everyone number would be, you know, a tenth of what it is now if we always agreed on stuff. I think that his point of view is a valid one, though I think he's, you know, God bless you, Len. I know you're going to listen to this, and so I don't want to be mean. I think you'll come around. I think he's
Come around on in what sense?
He'll come around on Dave and Mark not being the con men he thinks they are. He can disagree with them, and I disagree with them on some stuff too, but I don't think they're doing it to like rip anybody off or, you know, damage Bitcoin or anything like that. I just, you know, disagreeing with someone is fine. I think they have a pretty solid ethic. I didn't, you know, mention to Mark and David yesterday, but one of the things Bitcoin Magazine does that I really wanted to shine a light on, you know, when it comes to like who they have at their conference and what they publish and stuff like that, they have a publicly available kind of rubric to tell people, here's the answer you can expect if you come to us with X, Y, or Z request. Speak, to sponsor, to publish, whatever. And I don't know a lot of other companies who do that. I don't know a lot of, you know, what's a good example here? Who's someone who really is like, you know, revered in Bitcoin? You know, has Saylor given a reason why he doesn't sponsor open source devs? No. Everyone forgot about it. No one's holding his feet to the fire.
Yeah, good point.
You know what I mean? Like, these guys they're pretty transparent. Anyway, I want you to ask questions, not me. I just want to say, like, the disagreement is fine. It's good. And I think ultimately, Len, you will come around, buddy. I think you will.
Yeah, I think the debate and the drama really centers around, obviously, ordinals. And I guess my position with ordinals, NFTs, whatever, is I don't fucking care. And I think that caring passionately, whether you really like them and you collect and you're buying NFTs and BRC20s and you're just that, like, you're so into that and you're fucking flipping them, I think that's retarded. But I also think that caring enough to get angry and to be like so upset about this and so upset about what it's doing to Bitcoin. I mean, yeah, I'm annoyed sometimes when the transaction fees are high. I get that. But like that's a much bigger problem than ordinals, right? Like, ordinals is just a symptom here of, I think that bigger picture, we didn't really understand the value of the the scarcity of block space and the scarcity of UTXOs and how to be efficient with UTXOs and the value of UTXOs. And I think we're finding out the value of UTXOs and how to value them. And that's going to be a process. I think ordinals is part of that process.
Yeah.
But I just don't care. And so, and like, if something as retarded and gay as ordinals is not going to break Bitcoin. Like, if it does, then I have wasted so much money. Like, this is the dumbest thing to destroy what is supposed to be the greatest technology. I just do not care. So the way I approach it is, it is a big deal though. Like, it is, they're not going away. They are causing disruptions. They're causing disruptions. I mean, whenever the price spikes in something like a fee market for block space, that is a signal. That is telling you something's important. That's telling you something's happening. Mm-hmm. So to just ignore it would be foolish. It's stupid. Whether you like it or not, it's valuable. It's important to learn about it, to understand it, to try to figure out what the implications are, to figure out, is it a bug? Is it an exploit? Is it a revolutionary new way? Is this something we can filter? Like, you should learn about it. And I think that they, at the very least, Bitcoin Magazine is covering what is the only obvious thing to cover. I mean, it's like I said, like, ordinals to me is like Taylor Swift. I refuse to care, but for some reason people care. And so why would they not cover it? They cover a lot of other things. And they're, like you said, they're very transparent. But I think, to go back to your interview, I think you did an impressive job of being critical and of taking the other side and kind of like clarifying and making them respond to, like, you're like, David's investing in all these things in UTXO. I agree that is, I wouldn't invest in those things. I don't think they're the most.
Have you seen the portfolio?
I haven't looked at it in a while. I know, but I know it's just
there's a lot of weird stuff on there.
Right.
That's not, yeah. I mean, whatever. I think Bailey's he's a decent guy. If I was him,
I agree.
You know what I mean? Like, I'll ask you guys, if you were running a magazine that was writing about Bitcoin, and you had another sort of private fund that invested in Bitcoin companies, would you still use the private fund, which, by the way, is just to feather your nest, right? It's not it's not related to the magazine on paper. There's no, you know, legal linkage between the two. If you thought you could make a quick buck, why not just do it? And one of the things I wanted to ask Dave yesterday is, you know, I think people are conflating often, if you think about how VC works, people are conflating often UTXO's investment in a product as the endorsement of that product. That's not how VC works. When you invest in a company, what you're trying to do is get the company off the ground, help build the profile, help build the product, and then get the fuck out as quickly as possible with as much money as you can. It doesn't mean you like the product. It just means you think it's a decent investment. Those two things are conflated by the Bitcoin crowd, which tells me, unfortunately, that the anonymous laser eyed maxis don't have a clue how investing works. You have to have some understanding of how it works, right? And like Swan takes some shit too. And I when I think about that, I'm like, why? What is the problem here? People have fiduciary responsibilities to their boards, to their investors, to their whatever. These things shouldn't be conflated. They are not the same. And I don't think they represent the intentions or the hearts and minds of the people involved, quite honestly. And I think Bailey's been painted unfairly in some respects with that kind of broad stroke.
I don't know David Bailey well or anything. I only know of him. He seems like a decent dude. I don't think he's an evil scammer.
Yeah.
He's a degenerate. I mean, they bought that company in Japan. They're going to buy Bitcoin. They just pumped the bags, right? But yes, he is a degenerate. He is a capitalist, right? But if you're going to hate the player, you don't hate the player, hate the game, right?
That's right.
What Donald Trump do in the 2016 debates where he said, I'm using all of these tax loopholes and all these write-offs and I know about them. And so does Hillary. She wants to close it because her donors are the ones that wrote them. She's the one that put this in place. I'm just using it, right? So but he's a degenerate, but like you said, he's transparent. They're not trying to pull one by, if you criticize him, he engages, he lets you submit your point of view.
Yeah.
I don't think that they're the problem. The drama, some people that may want to defend Bitcoin Magazine and David, they say they don't deserve the heat and the drama. They invite it. I mean, that's what they're doing. He's a businessman. He knows what he's doing.
100%.
This drama is fantastic for his company. It's fantastic for the bottom line. It's fantastic for the conference. It drives attention towards Bitcoin. It drives attention to all this stuff. I think they know what they're doing. They're good at it. They're covering it well. They cover it well. So they're good at it, explaining and educating and informing. That's what a journalism or a journalist is supposed to do. A media outlet's supposed to do. It doesn't matter if you like it.
No, exactly. And think about this, right? If I look at what Bitcoin Magazine has done on the pub side and on the conference side, how many companies have tried to replicate it to feather their own nests in their own respect? Everybody. Pacific Bitcoin took some of the best stuff from the Bitcoin conference, the Canadian Bitcoin conference, which is in a few weeks, same thing. Madeira, same thing. Everyone is looking at Bitcoin Magazine. They love to hate and just pile on the stuff they don't like. But
yeah,
I mean, even listening to the interview yesterday, if you listen to Mark talk about what he thinks about stuff like ordinals, ETFs, all that, and then if you look at Dave's Twitter and see what he thinks about ordinals, ETFs, I think yesterday he was like, no, I don't like the ETF. I just think it's inevitable. I think he fucking likes it. And I said that to him. It sounds to me like he likes it. Those two guys are the sort of, two heads of the snake at Bitcoin Magazine, right? You got the Mark on the publishing side, publishing all sorts of stuff about the dark connections between BlackRock, the government, why the ETF is dicey, why Tether is dicey, stable coins, the CBDCs being dicey. And then on the other side, you got ordinals, inscriptions, whatever else going on at the conference. These guys, if they were really, if David Bailey especially, because he takes more shit than Mark does, so I'll defend him for a second. If he was really focused on pumping his bags, Goodwin would be the last guy he would have in charge of making editorial decisions for the magazine. He'd be the last guy. There's a million other people who would lick the boot of David Bailey to get that role and do whatever he wanted. But he clearly doesn't want that. The magazine clearly doesn't want that. And all the people who support the magazine and the quote-unquote scams also clearly don't want that. So who, this is the other thing, right? Who wants it? How many people, for the people who think Bitcoin Magazine is driving ordinal craze or driving Bitcoin trends or driving any of this any of the cultural phenomena that are resonating with the average Bitcoiner, how many people do you think read Bitcoin Magazine? What is the number?
Is it
50,000 top end? It's probably a third of that, tenth of that. I don't know. But like, come on, you really think that these guys are, you can't be serious. That's not a serious opinion. If you think that, like, what, how can I reason with you? That's just not the way this is going, man.
And a lot of people, like, we work at Swan, right? So like, there's this, a perspective online, like, that it's like Swan versus Bitcoin Magazine.
No,
which
way.
Is just like, it's so oversimplified. Like, yeah, there's definitely some outspoken criticism from Swan side of Bitcoin Magazine. And sometimes they spat with each other over like, I mean, it's Bitcoin Twitter where you fight.
Yeah. And guess what, Dan? Yeah. It's good for you too. It's good.
Of course.
It's good for you the same way it's good for them. And everyone else who's watching is enjoying it too. You know,
of
like,
course,
everyone's having a good time. Who gives a fuck? It's not like that.
Yeah, but God. Like the people that come at Swan, and it's same thing with Bitcoin Magazine. It's like, you know what Swan is. It's like, you know who our customers, like, they're building this custodial solution mostly for institutions.
Yeah.
And the most of the customer base is just like old boomers who want to self-custody. They just want to call somebody and have them talk about how Bitcoin's great, and then they get the transaction done for them. They don't actually put in any numbers. They're just talking to somebody on a phone. And they're taking self-custody. And it's like, that's what the company does. We do it well for the people who need us. And it's all just driving all this drama. That's just driving attention. It's just driving attention. And people are learning. People are learning, like, oh, I'm a customer at Swan. I guess I'm getting bullied because I'm a cuck because I use a custodian. I could probably take, you know, possession of my private keys in a cold storage wallet and not use a custodian anymore. That's good. I'm glad that customer on their journey learned to be self-sovereign and left.
Yeah.
Like that's good for Bitcoin. It's good for them. It's a fun industry to be in.
The other thing I don't get is, like, you know, and we kind of danced around this earlier. The thing that really drives me nuts that I think Mark and Dave said yesterday that it should resonate with people in Bitcoin. If you think, okay, that the biggest, most important thing for you to have your attention on right now is whether or not some guy who came from Solana is, you know, writing Pepes on Bitcoin, man, you got another thing coming. You got to focus your attention on things that really matter. And the things that really matter are yet to come, that they're starting to be visible on the horizon here. Don't get confused about who the enemy is. The enemy is not Bitcoin Magazine. And like I said yesterday, how many other publications in traditional media or Bitcoin media ran the trucker story front page?
Right.
All the articles, all the commentary, all the support. No one else did that. Is this guy really your enemy? I have a hard time believing that there are people out there who claim to be, quote unquote, like Bitcoin maxis, in it for the long haul. I've been around for a long time. I'm an OG. View Bitcoin Magazine as the enemy. There's guys who are like truly like scammy types. You know, when I think about like Jameson Lopp, a few years ago, around the same time that Trace Mayer disappeared, was at a conference pumping this Grin token thing, and everyone just forgot about it. I think about Dan Held, same thing, pumping all this other bullshit. Meltem Demirers or whatever her name is, pumping all kinds of bullshit.
Breedlove, BitClout.
Breedlove, BitClout. These people are like revered in the space. Should they be? Like, if you had to pick your sort of top five heels, I don't think Bitcoin Magazine or anyone on their staff should be in the top five. And if you really want to go like outside of just the individual enemies of Bitcoin, you know, these guys are not even in the top 100. Certainly not now. Maybe 5 years ago when we were all bored and the price was $3,000, but not now. And you got to really pay attention now, because if we're not all marching under the same banner, we got a problem. Because the clamps are coming down, people are getting more serious, and we got to be serious too, instead of talking about whether or not David Bailey is getting rich on ordinals. Who fucking cares, man? Who cares? Doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a great place to wrap it up. I think the way I would piggyback off of what you said was, everybody deserves criticism, and everybody deserves, when you first meet them or first approach them, to be sort of like, maybe they are the enemy of Bitcoin, but have some common sense and think about who you need to be focusing your energy on, and trying to help yourself, trying to protect freedom, privacy, sovereignty. most of it right now is coming from Washington, D.C.
Totally.
And the Federal Reserve and those places. So right now it's time to prioritize who we're fighting. And I think that it's a good thing to remember that.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Oh, yeah, man. Where can people...
I just want to say, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Like, I just love all the concepts and ideas. They make me think about a lot of stuff.
It's my pleasure to come and talk to you guys, man. I think that there's not enough opportunity for people, like the three guys like us, who, you know, may not be huge names, but have been around long enough and seen enough, and I think have like valuable inputs, insights, and opinions on Bitcoin and the sort of future and threats.
Perspective,
and, you know what I mean? Like these are important discussions. And, you know, my sincerest hope is that, you know, in 10 years or 15 years, we'll be able to look back on these. And even though we probably got some stuff wrong, say, you know, we were on to something here. We did the right things. We made the decisions we thought were best with the information we had at the time. It'll be fun to look back on these. And I don't know, hopefully I'll be doing it from like a citadel somewhere. But not, then we just haven't made it to hyper Bitcoinization yet, right?
For sure. Yeah, I think I tell a lot of people, don't listen to what I say. Like, I'll try to ask the right questions and try to give you the best summary of what I know. But just make sure you don't trust, verify, like fucking figure it out for yourself, right? But if you want to, if you guys want to check out, listen to Joey and Len go back and forth, I think you guys do a really good job of covering the ins and outs of like what's going on the day to day and like how to frame how you think about it. I think it's a good discussion. So if people want to listen, where do they find all your podcasts?
CanadianBitcoiners.com is the website. We record and stream every Monday night and most Tuesdays or Wednesdays. We didn't do a show tonight because we did Bitcoin Magazine yesterday, but we're always live. We do everything live. You guys should do this live. Have a little live chat there. It's like a little petri dish of people swimming around, you know, talking to each other. And if you want like way more content, there's like a Discord that Len started that has, I don't know, like 250 people in it or something. They're always talking about Bitcoin stuff. So if you're really like lonely in the middle of the night and you want to chat, someone will be there. I don't know where they'll be from or if they're a, you know, sex bot or something, but you'll get a response at least. So that's good, I guess.
And do you guys cover the other Bitcoin adjacent topics? You got raw milk, eating beef,
I talk about that.
Paying for eggs with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'll leave you with an anecdote. I made a friend at the gym like maybe a month ago because I had a shirt on from the Regenesance. I don't know if you guys ever know this guy, Ryan. I can't remember his last name. Ryan, geez, I forget now. But Regenesance is his outfit, and he basically makes this gray shirt with a big bottle of milk on the back. And the shirt just says, raw is law. And it's fucking raw. Awesome. It's fucking awesome. I love that stuff. I would be happy to talk about that anytime, but we don't talk about it on the show much. No, I don't think Len's been under a barbell for some time, if ever, but, you know, it's okay. Everyone's got their own thing. Right.
And it also part of the, is NHL 94 part of the network?
So it is. Yeah. Video games, we do some other podcasts. Like I do a couple other ones with my brother-in-law. We do one for Access of Easy with Easy DNS, and Len does one for NHL 94. Actually, I saw before we started recording that he did one tonight with somebody. It's a good show. I've never played that game. I'm too young for it, but I listen to most of the episodes. I think it's pretty funny. People who are passionate about something, if they want to talk about it, I'm going to be there to listen and support it for sure.
Hell yeah. So it sounds to me like whatever's going on in Canada, they are subsidizing podcasts. There's so many podcasts coming out of Canada.
A lot going on in Canada on the mic, yeah.
You guys get like your UBI just for like working for the government up there, and like it gives you time to podcast. That's awesome.
Everybody,
I love it.
Everybody's on a UBI checkout here, and they're just paying for studios left and right.
If the United States had universal basic income, we'd have quadrupled the podcast. Yeah. That would be awesome.
You got to get that.
Fountains would be the biggest company in the world.
We can finally get Mike his new computer. True. You just need the UBI check for podcasters.
Oh, good. Yeah, we had a total hiccup before we started recording. That was hilarious.
It was good to talk to you guys, man. I'm glad we finally got this done.
For sure.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
We'll try to get you and Len on at the same time and get you guys to fight each other.
You know, he's never been to my house to record a show. So when we do that, I would like to have him in the other chair here so I could at least stare him down while he's talking about how much of a scammer my friends are.
A high hash rate exclusive. Cool.
That means that Dan and I have to meet in the same place too.
Oh, there we go. There you go.
That's what that means.
We've done it before.
All right, cool.
All right.
That's I'll cut it. Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate Podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked ADIQ plebs, reach out to us at hello@highhashrate.com. Or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!